This is Jessica Levinson, a professor at Loyola Law School and the vice president of the Los Angeles Ethics Commission. I'm pleased to be sitting in for Ian Masters today, filling in on Background Briefing. We have a packed show today. We're going to be talking with Dahlia Lithwick, a senior reporter for Slate, talking about the Supreme Court's recent decisions today, or decisions not to make decisions in the gay marriage cases. We'll be talking with Jean Merle, a reporter for the Los Angeles Times, about a number of political issues facing California. And we'll be speaking with Jojo Liu, co-director of Loyola's Juvenile Justice Clinic, talking about a number of issues facing the juvenile justice system. We're joined by Dahlia Lithwick. She is a senior editor and legal coordinator at Slate. She writes about the Supreme Court, a variety of judicial issues, and the psyche of Muppets. Dahlia's writing is as smart as it is funny, and she has a unique gift for making complicated legal issues feel clear and accessible. And I'm so glad that you're joining us today, the first day of the Supreme Court's 2014-2015 term. And so it's been a big day. Can you tell our listeners what is happening and why are people getting marriage licenses today? What went on this morning?
It was a big, big day. And I think more than anything, a surprising day. I think everybody felt like the marriage equality cases, you know, there were seven different appeals. There were all these different circuit courts that were in abeyance, you know, these stays that everybody, you know, was just waiting for the court to take this. The court had ordered expedited briefing. The court looked like it really wanted to take these cases, and that was supposed to be the story, was that the court had taken one, and instead the court just denied cert on all of them, which means they declined to hear any of these cases from various appeals courts, all of which had struck down, by the way, same-sex marriage bans. And in denying them, the court basically gave the green light to those states that were appealing and arguably to other states in the jurisdictions that the appeals courts sit in to go ahead and get same-sex marriage licenses. And we're seeing in Oklahoma, we're seeing in Virginia, already folks have queued up and received same-sex marriage licenses. So it is a huge day. I think five states immediately have to allow same-sex marriage, and six more will inevitably do so. I think Colorado is going to as well. And so we are literally looking at a world in which by the end of, you know, the next couple of weeks, there will be 30 states that allow same-sex marriage. And that is just an unbelievable change from where we were, not just, you know, 5 years ago, but even where we were a year ago.
I do not think that we would have been having this conversation in 2013, for sure, saying a majority of states in the U.S. are allowing for gay marriage.
It's remarkable. It's a sea change. And these are the kinds of social movements that, you know, can take decades to unfold. And what we've seen since the Supreme Court's 2013 decision in Windsor, the DOMA case, the defense of marriage case, is court after court after court reading the opinion that didn't go so far as to say state bans on same-sex marriage are unconstitutional, reading that opinion to say that that's in there. And every single court, with the exception of two, who has struck down a same-sex marriage ban, every court has tagged it to that Windsor decision and said there is a constitutionally protected right to same-sex marriage and cited Windsor. So it is a dramatic day, and at the same time, you know, it's interesting that the court isn't the one making the decision. The court is making a decision not to make that decision.
Well, was this all part of the Supreme Court's plan in Windsor? They could have taken it across the finish line, and they didn't. Was this part of the long game that Justice Roberts likes to play, or is this what Justice Kennedy envisioned?
I think everybody's wondering, Jessica, what went on in the minds of the nine in issuing these denials. And the truth is, we may not know for years and years. Either someone's going to leak something, or we're going to find out when papers are released. But I don't think anyone really truly knows, except the justices themselves, how they got here. There's an awful lot of theories being floated about, you know, the liberals were nervous that Justice Anthony Kennedy, who was that critical fifth vote wasn't fully on board. There are theories that the four conservatives were afraid that Anthony Kennedy would go way too far and proclaim all sorts of constitutional rights that would open the door to many, many other challenges, not just limited to marriage. But the truth is, we just don't know. There was no analysis in the order. They simply declined to hear the cases. So your guess is as good as mine. It seems that at least at some level, those of us who thought this is the term that the court is finally ready to take this on were wrong, and they may be waiting. The Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals, another appeals court, has a case pending where they may in fact uphold the ban. Then we'll have a split, because right now virtually every court, and certainly every appeals court who's heard these cases, have voted the same way. So maybe the court wants to see somebody not sign off, and then we really have a fight on our hands. But any way you slice it, it was a perplexing move in the term that we thought was going to give us a definitive answer.
A perplexing move, but as you said, a sea change. And we'll have to wait for the Brethren part two, I guess, to really find out what happened. But I'd like to take a step back and talk about the Supreme Court a little more generally. I know you've talked about this a lot recently because Erwin Chemerinsky, dean of UCI, has just come out with a book called The Case Against the Supreme Court. So he's really left us wondering in the title what he means. And I know you've spoken with him about this book. A lot of people are frustrated by our current Supreme Court, and they know the names of rulings like Citizens United, and they know something like corporations are not people and money is not speech, or McCutcheon, or they know Shelby deals with voting rights, or they know about the Hobby Lobby case that you've written so brilliantly about. But from your perspective as one of the top court watchers, what is it that plagues the Supreme Court these days?
Well, I think that, you know, at one level, we just all, I think, can agree that the court has moved quite dramatically to the right of where it was, you know, in the days when we called it the O'Connor Court, when the moderating ninth vote, that centrist vote of the court, was truly at the center. And O'Connor was a sort of interesting character because even though her jurisprudence drove people crazy, it was interesting to see that her view of the world from affirmative action, campaign finance, abortion, you know, voting, each of these sort of areas of doctrine, her views kind of tracked those of the bulk of American people. She was strangely not an extremist in any direction, and I think that drove a lot of people bonkers. But the truth is that when she was replaced by Samuel Alito, who really, I think it's fair to say, is quite radically to her right, the center fell out. And the court became a court that, instead of pivoting around a centrist swing justice, pivots around Anthony Kennedy, who is, again, to her right. So I think that one thing that we're seeing is that this is a court that is, and, you know, these studies have been done, and you've seen them as well as I have, the most conservative Supreme Court that we've had in 100 years. I mean, this is a court that has four of the most conservative jurists now sit on the Supreme Court since the FDR era. So it is a very, very conservative court. And at the same time, I think it's a court that does things in small incremental ways. And so we don't always see the big Hobby Lobby case. We don't always see the big Shelby County case. We see tiny infinitesimal moves, and we saw several of those last term, almost teeing up the next one, but never quite going big when they can go small. And so I think one of the things that's really interesting is that public opinion generally finds the court to be about in the middle, even though I don't think by any measurable metric the court has done anything but move to the right. So it's simply an interesting court. And I guess I would say, and this is part of Dean Chemerinsky's complaint about the court. In some sense, the court was constituted to have people sit on the bench for 15, 20-year terms. Now you can have people who can sit for 30 years. So it's kind of not just that it's fixed and immutable, but it's fixed and immutable forever. And I think that worries some people. There's a sense that, A, the justices are old and out of touch, and they don't fully understand how we live our lives. But B, that they stay there forever nonetheless. So that seems to be, I mean, there's a lot of complaints swirling around about the court, and certainly from the right you hear similar complaints that say, you know, why won't this court stop citing foreign law? Why does this court keep finding rights to gay marriage? So I think that it's a court that takes hits from all sides, but I think that the gist of a complaint is that it was not meant to be an institution that simply doesn't ever change.
Well, and that's one of, I know, the solutions at the end of Dean Chemerinsky's book is maybe we should think about term limits, you know, something I frankly dislike when it comes to legislators, but legislators stand for elections, and of course, federal judges don't. And I know he talks about other things in the book dealing with the selection and appointment process, taking out the magic wand that I know you have next to you right now. What are a few things that you would like to see to reform the Supreme Court, if you don't mind commenting on that?
You know, I'm not quite as certain as Dean Chemerinsky that I am for term limits, largely because, you know, I look at Ruth Bader Ginsburg, I look at John Paul Stevens, and I believe that they are doing, you know, a great job well into their 80s, and I'm not sure that there's a really principled reason to take them to take that away, and obviously it would require amending the Constitution. So I think there's that. But I think that some of the change that Chemerinsky suggests are ones that I would echo, and they largely have to do with transparency, Jessica. They largely have to do with having cameras in there, with having coherent ethics rules that the justices have to explain when they recuse from a case or when they don't or when they have a conflict. All of the things that happen in secret, in the dark, need to happen openly the way they happen in other branches of government. And so I think many, many of the suggested fixes I would have would just kind of be classed under demystifying the court, not giving the court 100% discretion over its own operations, because when it's given that discretion, it acts in its own selfish interests and not the interests of transparency and openness. And I just think, as one of three co-equal branches of government, it's deeply strange to me that the presumption for the court is secrecy and, you know, kind of locked down unknowable things instead of the presumption that we see in the other branches, which is openness, transparency, and inclusiveness. And I do think that one of the reasons, looping back to your last question, that Americans get very weirded out by the court is because it looks an awful lot like a magic temple, some oracular place where mystical things happen in front of a red velvet curtain. And that, I don't think, sits right with folks in a democracy, certainly in a century where we have so much access to other branches of government.
I am looking forward to the day when there is a live stream of Supreme Court arguments and you and I are live tweeting each other and waving through the live stream, through the red velvet cloak that has been lifted and is no longer secret. So why don't we close, because you mentioned RBG, the notorious RBG, Justice Ginsburg, who was recently bench pressing me and, you know, is working well into her 80s, because you wrote what I thought was a very compelling piece that actually changed my mind on the issue about why she should not be forced to step down right now, even though I think to a lot of progressives and liberals, it feels like we want to make sure that everything she worked for can stand. And we're worried what's going to happen if the Senate goes Republican and what happens if a Republican president is in place and we see another Justice Alito who's appointed. Could you outline for our readers why you actually think it's a good idea for her to stay on? Because I thought it was a very, very compelling piece.
Well, there's a couple things. I mean, I think probably the most critical thing is it's not up to us to choose. You know, these are lifetime appointments, barring some kind of horrific, impeachable bad behavior. So we don't get to choose. What we get to do is pressure her. And at the most basic level, I find it deeply unseemly for people to be pressuring justices to retire, particularly when we were pressuring them to retire in public ways for just brazen political reasons. All of that entire conversation sort of flies in the face of the way we think about the judicial branch. So I think there's just the pure kind of optics of people hollering at a justice that it's time to go because she's going to die. But beyond that, I think that there is a kind of valence of gender around this that makes me very nervous. I think that Justice Ginsburg is feeling pressed to retire. It's making her angry. You know, nobody was pressing, for instance, John Paul Stevens, who retired much, much later in his life than Ginsburg did. There's a way in which it simply has this look of being able to push the women around. And if you think back to the fact that Justice Sandra Day O'Connor actually did retire under pressure, that she wanted to stay on for another year, and then Chief Justice William Rehnquist persuaded her to leave before she was ready. I think it must feel it like it really rankles to her that all the women get pushed off and the men get to stay as long as they want. And so I think that's a piece of it, too. But I do think, ultimately, she's at the top of her game. She is the senior leader, you know, in assigning minority opinions. That is an enormous amount of power. She has really, I think, tried to get the four liberal justices to coalesce around a certain vision. I think she's done that quite masterfully. And then just in her own right, if you look at the Hobby Lobby dissent, you look at the Shelby County dissent, look at the Walmart dissent, look at the Lilly Ledbetter dissent. She has been writing at the height of her powers. And so the notion that she is going to be, against her will, forced off the court and then replaced by someone is a little bit perplexing in light of the fact, and she said this herself recently in an interview with Elle magazine, she doesn't think there's any chance that Obama could replace her with someone like her. And so I think her feeling is, let me stay and do this fantastic work I'm doing. And if you really, truly care about who follows me, get a Democrat elected. And that's, you know, don't push me off the court. Make sure you elect a Democrat to follow Obama. And if and when I go, have them put someone like me on the court. So it's I think those are pretty solid reasons. And I do think, as I said, there's something a little bit unseemly about trying to force her off when she truly is, I would say, at the top of her game.
Well, Dahlia Lithwick, never unseemly, but always very educational and enjoyable. I really appreciate your time today, and I know our listeners are smarter for having heard you.
Well, thank you for having me.
Thank you so much. Now we're going to take a quick break, and then we'll be back speaking with Jean Merle of the Los Angeles Times. River running free.
It's a new day, it's a new life for me, and I'm feeling good.
I'm going out of west where I belong, where the days are short and the nights are long, where they won't, and I won't, they twist. They shimmy, and I'll shimmy. They fly, and I'll fly. Well, they're out there having fun in that warm California sun. Well, I'm going out of west.
Joining us now is Jean Merle. I love Jean's bio on the LA Times website, so I'm going to read it for the audience. Jean Merle, a hopeless news junkie, covers regional politics for the Los Angeles Times. She was raised in southern Ohio but moved with her family to Los Angeles at a tender age, which practically makes her a California native, which makes you, by the way, a rarity. She holds a master's degree from UCLA and remembers when Otis Chandler was publisher of the Los Angeles Times and Tom Bradley was mayor of LA. I make a point of reading whatever Jean has written, and she is one of my go-to sources for all things political in California. Thank you for joining us, Jean.
Oh, thank you, Jessica. That's an awesome introduction.
Oh, good. We'll stick with that. So it is the beginning of October, which means that the November 4th elections are fast approaching, and a lot of people outside of our news junkie bubble are starting to think about the election. So I wanted to talk about a couple of issues that you've written about recently. Could you preview for our readers what are some big things to look for in the next elections?
Well, I think one of the things that's interesting to me is, you know, because California is such a heavily Democratic state, there's not much competition for the statewide offices, and the Republican Party is trying very hard to rebuild itself. So a lot of the action is going to be in races for the legislature and for the congressional seats in California, which I think is kind of interesting that there's some competitive races there when this is such a strongly Democratic state.
Yes, you know, there's really nothing happening. As you said, there's no campaign on the gubernatorial level. I mean, I think that an asteroid has to hit the Earth and then we need a blue moon in order for Jerry Brown to lose re-election.
Yeah.
On the one seat down for lieutenant governor, I think we're certainly looking at Gavin Newsom. And then AG, it will again be Attorney General Harris. So I think the biggest race that people are looking at may be really Secretary of State and Controller on the state level.
Yeah. And it's certainly possible for Republicans to win those races, but it's not looking terribly likely. And so then all the real drama and the real battleground seem to be for a handful of legislative and congressional seats. And there you see true competition going on in a handful of these seats.
So could we talk about a couple of those legislative and congressional seats? I know you wrote recently about some hot House races.
Yes. I'm mainly concentrating on congressional races, and my colleagues in Sacramento are writing about the legislative races. But what they do have in common is that in each of these, there's just a few seats, and there's a lot of the party leaders are playing heavily in those few races because Democrats want to hold their seats, and in the legislature, they want to hold or get back. In the case of the Senate, they're supermajority. And Republicans are hoping that if they can pick up some seats, they can signal to Californians that they are on their way back. So there's a lot at stake for the parties in these races.
Which are some of the races that are starting to heat up, if you could call it a few for our listeners?
Sure. There's about five or six in congressional seats in California that have become real battlegrounds. And four of them are for seats that the Democrats took from a Republican 2 years ago when President Obama was reelected and there was a good turnout. And those seats are now considered to be at risk from a Democratic perspective because turnout will be lower. President Obama is not doing so well in the polls, although his numbers are coming up a little bit. And typically, midterm elections are the ones that have an older, whiter, more conservative turnout than when there's a presidential election. And so the seats that were won in a climate that's favorable to Democrats 2 years ago, they're now having to defend them in a not-so-favorable climate. And both national parties and their allies are playing very big in those races. A couple of them, well, the three ones that are believed to be the closest at 4 weeks out, are the seat that Scott Peters won from Brian Bilbray in San Diego County. Then there's one that Ami Bera won from Dan Lundgren up in the Sacramento area. And then one right much closer to us, Ventura County, where Julia Brownlee won a seat that had been held by Elton Gallagher, a Republican, for a long time. It was not exactly the same seat because of redistricting, but it was considered a swing district that could go to either party, and the Democrat won it then, and now Republicans are thinking they have a pretty good shot at taking it back.
Well, you mentioned redistricting. So if we could take a step out of the November 4th elections for a second, we implemented two pretty big reforms recently in California. The top two election, which, as you know, creates a system where any voter can vote for any candidate in the primary, and then the top two vote getters, regardless of party affiliation, proceed to the general, which is in essence a runoff. And then redistricting, for the first time in the state's history, we had an independent redistricting commission as opposed to the legislators, drawing their own lines.
Right.
And if you could tell our listeners, because I think this is something that is hard for us to figure out, have these reforms affected elections in California? Is it too soon to tell? Has there been a small effect thus far? What are you observing?
Well, they have in small ways, and I think they will even more as time goes on. Most voters, particularly the independent voters, the ones who are the no party preference, as they're calling them now, haven't yet really figured out what kind of power they have. Many of them are not used to voting in the primaries, or they don't understand how the whole thing works, and that with the top two primary system, most of the big decision-making comes in the primary. So if you're going to vote in an election you care about, make sure you get to the primary, even if you're not a Democrat or a Republican or affiliated with a party, because that's really where the determinant comes. And then once the primary is over, the only two names that will be on the ballot are the names of the first and second place finishers. And it doesn't matter if they are from the same party, if one of them's an independent, if one of them was a write-in candidate in the primary. Those are the two and the only two that are going to be on the ballot in that particular race. So there's a lot of authority has shifted to the primary election, and I don't think a lot of voters have really realize that yet. And then as far as the redistricting goes, some people have asked, well, if we've had redistricting and supposedly we don't have gerrymandered districts anymore, then how come most of the legislative districts in the state are either strongly Republican or strongly Democratic? So that doesn't seem to have changed much. But they're strongly Democratic or strongly Republican for different reasons, not because they were gerrymandered, but because people tend to kind of sort themselves residentially by people they have other things in common with. And so you have big clumps of Democrats living in Los Angeles and San Francisco, and then farther east, those are the sort of more Republican territories. And so even an honest and pure, as some people like to call it, redistricting, one that at least the aim is to take the incumbent protection element out of it, even those, when you have that kind of residential sorting, you're still going to get districts that are naturally favor one party or the other. And then there's a few in the middle that are truly swing districts. They could go either way for a whole bunch of reasons, including some of the demographics.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I mean, there's only so much an independent redistricting commission can or should do, because people in Orange County tend to have a different party affiliation than people who live in Malibu or Topanga. And I think that's not necessarily the purview of an independent redistricting commission to try and change that. So,
right. Well, they couldn't if they wanted.
They could.
Their charge was to take the incumbent protection element out of it and to kind of try to include a number of other factors in, you know, how communities of interest, things like that, into where the lines were drawn, and not, gee, let's make this a safe seat for Congressman X.
Which is how they used to be drawn.
Right, absolutely.
You said something that was interesting with respect to the top two. You said the authority has really shifted to the primary, and that you talked about the power of the no-party preference voters of you know, and I am one of those no party preference voters. If you look at the way the demographics are shifting in California, I believe it's the case that the no party preference voters are the fastest growing percentage of the electorate.
They sure are. In fact, if things keep up the way they're going, they've been going in the last few years, even before the top two primary came into play, they were a fast growing bloc. According to the Secretary of State's latest voter registration figures, the Republican registration is now down to about 28%, and the no party preference or independent registration is at 23%. So it won't be long, unless things change for the better for the Republican Party, it won't be long before the no party preference folks surpass them in California.
What does that mean? A lot of people talk about, is this the demise of the Republican Party in California? What do statewide offices look like? What does the legislature look like if that happens? And how much do we know about the behavior of these no party preference voters?
Well, I think it's too soon to predict the demise of the Republican Party, although it seems like, you know, they just seem to be digging themselves in deeper and deeper. But they've got a chairman with some ideas about how to improve things. And and I think it's, you know, nature doesn't seem to like things to be terribly out of balance, and that's including political nature. And usually when one party gets a little too much authority, they find a way to blow it, and there's some kind of backlash against that. And things tend to straighten themselves out a little bit. As far as the no party preference voters, a lot of them are not really as nonpartisan as that label or their registration status would seem to imply.
So tell me about me.
Okay, well, a lot of those NPP voters were formerly affiliated with a party, and usually one of the major political parties. And for whatever reason, they decided to leave and to re-register. You know, one of my colleagues who's covered politics here for years and years and years has always been very open about, he's been a no party preference voter for years. He just feels that as somebody who's covering politics, he should not be registered with any party. And I think there's probably a lot of people, maybe not a lot, but a substantial number of non-affiliated voters that feel that they don't, you know, voter registration records are more or less public, and they don't want to be publicly seen as favoring one party or the other. Some people feel that they like the idea that now they have the power to vote in a primary, and that there's really no, maybe they don't want to belong to one party or the other. They want to have the freedom to feel like they can go back and forth. They're not going to end up getting hit up for donations, or, you know, they're not joiners. They don't like going to party gatherings or whatever. So, but they're not, you know, they don't really vote as a bloc. And people seem to feel, the people who were the advocates for the top two primary seem to feel that this would force, having a top two primary would force the candidates to become more moderate, that they would have to appeal across a broader spectrum. I don't really think we've seen a lot of that play out yet, but again, it's early, and usually it takes several election cycles before these things can play out. But I think probably the one thing you can say about the independent voters is that they don't vote as a bloc. They're not a group. Some of them are very conservative. Some are very liberal, and everything in between. So it's hard for political consultants to know how to reach these groups. They can figure out by their past party affiliations where they're likely to go, but that's a laborious and not foolproof way of of judging who you target when you're trying to get out your voters and keep the other guy's voters from going to the polls.
Well, that pretty much describes me, a mysterious, disaffected non-joiner. So I think you hit the nail on the head with that one. I wanted to touch on another topic. I know you've written about, quote, the women's votes and specifically what Democratic candidates are trying to do to get women to the polls. And hopefully everyone's read your article, but maybe you can tell our listeners a little bit about that.
Sure, I'd be happy to. Well, one of the things that we've known for quite some time that there's a gender gap, that women tend to favor Democrats and men vote Republican, but it's also becoming clear that there's something called a marriage gap, in which unmarried women tend to vote big time for Democratic candidates, and that married women are a little more in the Republican column. I don't know if anybody's figured out exactly why that is. That's good news for the Democrats, because single women are one of the fastest growing demographic groups in the United States. The bad news for Democrats is that these women cannot be counted on to vote with any regularity. And so one of the things that the Democrats are trying to do in this midterm election year is try to mobilize their voters, Latinos, African Americans, single women, whoever they can count on to be their voters, to get them to the polls in any way that they can. And they've been doing that a number of ways, with big voter registration drives and trying to rally the base in like Central Valley districts and things like that. But one of their new wrinkles is the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, DCCC, to folks who like initials, has developed a computer model, and they call it ROSIE, after Rosie the Riveter. It's an acronym for something, but they deliberately wanted to bring it to mind, Rosie the Riveter of World War II fame. And it helps them identify which women are unmarried, whether they voted in recent presidential elections and didn't vote in the midterm elections, and then try to reach those women through phone banks, mailers, anything they can do to try to reach those women. They design campaign messages, things like equal pay for equal work, and access to health care, abortion rights, things that they believe will be important to those women, and try to get them motivated enough to get to the polls. So well, it'll be interesting to see if that works out for them.
It will be. So, Jean Merle, you left us with a very quotable quote before, which is, nature doesn't like things to be out of balance, and that includes the political process. This has been really useful for me, and I'm sure for our listeners, and I know that you're very busy, and I really appreciate your time, and it was wonderful to talk to you.
Oh, it's a pleasure, Jessica. Thank you so much.
Thanks for joining us.
You bet. Bye-bye.
Now we're going to take a quick break, and then we'll be back speaking with JoJo Liu, Clinical Director at Loyola Law School and Director of Loyola's Juvenile Justice Clinic. Our next guest is JoJo Liu. She is a clinical professor and a co-director at Loyola's Juvenile Justice Clinic. Prior to joining the Loyola faculty in 2007, she was a litigator at Morrison & Foerster, where her practice focused on white-collar criminal defense and FCPA compliance counseling. From 2000 to 2002, JoJo was a Skadden Fellow at Legal Services for Children, where she represented indigent disabled youths in suits against New York City Board of Education. JoJo is also a wonderful colleague, and I'm glad that she's joined the show today. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
So first, could you tell our listeners what Loyola's Juvenile Justice Clinic is? How was it formed, and what's its mission?
Sure, definitely. So our clinic was the founding project of the Center for Juvenile Law and Policy here at Loyola Law School. And it was founded 10 years ago really to support systemic reform in the juvenile justice system. We do it through direct legal representation, legislative advocacy, research, and encouraging dialogue. So 10 years ago, it was a particularly perilous time in juvenile justice. You know, it was an increasingly punitive time where we were seeing a real peak in the criminalization of youth behaviors. So at the clinic, we try to do a few things. We harness the energies of our law students to represent youth charged with offenses. We use what we call a holistic model of representation. Every client gets a social worker, an education attorney, in addition to the defense team. And what we're really hoping is that addresses not just the behaviors that we're seeing, but also the underlying causes. And, you know, through our direct advocacy, we see that as an entry point to identify systemic issues that we could hopefully impact. And we really are trying to educate our students in a manner that encourages the development of their identity as social advocates.
Well, I know a lot of students who have had a really good experience with the clinic. Could you tell us some of the more challenging aspects of working as the director of the Juvenile Justice Clinic?
Yeah. So, you know, the lives of our clients are very, very difficult.
Yes.
And our students really, they bear witness to a lot of tragedy and unfairness, and that can be really very hard. We just recently lost a case, a very long, hard-fought battle to keep a very traumatized client in juvenile court. So he was ultimately, despite our efforts, transferred to adult court and is facing adult charges there. And so this is a barely 16-year-old boy who had committed an armed robbery that did not result in injury. So this is a kid with severe learning issues, severely neglected since the age of 2, severely abandoned by his parents. His mom had died of cancer in front of him when he was 14. At the time of the robbery, he was homeless and destitute. So the fact that we could not convince the juvenile court that this child could not be rehabilitated, that he did not deserve to lose his status as a child, I mean, it was simply a real tragedy for our client and a very difficult result to live with. But, you know, it is really affirming that our students, that they can take away from this experience that work worth doing is almost by definition hard. They didn't choose to do this work because the system is fair or easy to navigate. And they also took away with it that fighting really hard for somebody is worth doing simply to convey the idea to your client that they're worth fighting for. And that's not a message that the children that we work with get a lot of. They're worthwhile people is not something that it's not affirmed very often for them, put it that way.
Well, that definitely sounds like challenging and rewarding work, and I know the students are really dedicated to it. Could we move from kind of the micro to the macro? I want to talk about the juvenile justice system in general. What are some of the biggest challenges facing the system right now? I know, of course, money is always a big issue, but you're inside the system. So many of us just talk about it. But what do you see?
So, you know, first I want to start that there's actually some really good news coming out of the juvenile justice system in California. We see a lot of good news lately. Filings, you know, cases referred to criminal courts or juvenile courts are down dramatically, and detention rates at the juvenile halls are also down. You might have heard that LAUSD has this new policy that they're going to stop referring minor offenses to the police. They're going to try to deal with behavioral issues at the school level. I don't know yet how that new policy is going to play out, but we definitely are seeing a lot of signs that we're starting to head in the right direction. We're starting to see that the criminal justice system, there's finally starting to be a paradigm shift that the
that the juvenile justice system and the criminal justice system should not be the system of first resort, but rather of last resort for youth. So, but despite all this good news, there's also a lot of hot spots still, a lot of work to be done. So, you know, kind of consistent with what's going on in society in general, I mean, the rise of the surveillance state, we also see this in juvenile justice. GPS monitoring has become something that counties are rolling out with great enthusiasm. And it's, you know, on one hand allowed detention in incarceration rates to go down. I think it's connected with why we're seeing less of a population in the juvenile halls. But, counties are being over-inclusive, really, in the kids that they're monitoring. And that's really a problem and where we're going to see some activity. Another real problem connected to the good news, on one hand, we're seeing, a real decline in criminalization of minor behavior. You know, but then one of the resulting problems is that there's this narrative now that, well, then the kids who are left in the system are really the worst of the worst, that we can now, consider those children to be really outside of the realm of children. You know, as advocates, we definitely dispute that characterization. And I think we're going to see our efforts with respect to trying to keep kids in juvenile court relative to adult court in some ways made harder by the fact that minor offenses are going away as a concern of the juvenile court.
Well, and it's interesting you said some of those children are almost not considered children anymore. Could you talk about how the changing social science and how the role of psychology is playing into juvenile justice right now and how much that's introduced in courts and may affect how we punish children?
Right. So there's this real disconnect because on one hand, the science, the brain science, what we know about adolescent development, what we know about the adolescent brain has already, it really emphasizes that even with very serious behaviors that they do not stop being children, that by definition, kids are different, that they have certain vulnerabilities, that they lack an ability, for example, to do risk assessment in the same way that an adult brain would be able to do that exercise. And the Supreme Court has recognized that in a number of cases. But what we're not seeing is either we're not seeing that brain science really being brought down to the front lines of these cases in state courts. And that's really the challenge that's left for juvenile defenders all around the country.
And how does that happen? Is it just a matter of introducing it to judges who are willing to hear it? Is it a matter of amassing more science? Is it a matter of getting more witnesses on the stand? How does one accomplish that goal?
I think it's being very aggressive about cultivating and using expert witnesses. I think that's a huge part of it. I think it's also advocates getting together and strategically deciding what issues they're going to push as an access point to bring in the science to the courts. So, where I'd like to see a paradigm shift is maybe an arena that's actually quite difficult, which is in the area of gangs. You know, for kids who are at the lower levels of the gang hierarchy, what the brain science really tells us about the vulnerabilities of children is that in some ways what's happening to them is analogous to what happens to children who are sexually trafficked, right? That they're really victims as opposed to predators. And we've really let this narrative get away from us that, someone is branded a gang member, even if they're 10, 11, 12, and somehow that's synonymous with the fact that they have now engaged in predatory behavior. And again, they're thought of as being somehow outside of the realm of children. When in fact, what's really happening is that their vulnerabilities as children are being exploited. And again, that may not be necessarily strategically the entry point for bringing brain science to the trial level, because in Los Angeles and with our history of gangs, that may not necessarily be the most palatable issue. But that's an example of where we could go with the brain science with good strategy.
Well, it's interesting. I wrote down that you said the narrative gets away from us. And you mentioned, politically in Los Angeles, that might be a difficult argument. How do you recapture the narrative when it comes to something like this?
Well, I think it's just it's very vigorous litigation, and it's challenging the assumptions, right, that everyone's making about your client, that when your client is labeled a gang member, that is not just, that it can't go unchallenged. Because up until now, the challenge has always been about this factual issue about whether or not he is or is not a gang member. And what has not been sufficiently challenged, I think, is what that actually means. Because that's really, I think, where the real crux of the issue is. What's happening with this child? What holes are in this young person's lives, and how do we fill it?
So it's taking a holistic view of each defendant and asking what the system can do beyond just putting them in, I think it's called camp.
Exactly, which at this point we know that empirically it really does not work. It really, there is not in any way a positive correlation in terms of preventing recidivism and highly punitive sentences. In fact, the empirical correlation is quite the opposite.
So we've talked about a couple of problems. What would you do if you could wave your magic wand and say, these are the top five things that I want for juvenile justice? I think we've touched on some of them. But, for listeners who are saying, we know there are problems, we want to hear from an expert about what the solutions are.
I would actually, a lot of times people ask me what non-lawyers can do. And I actually really would like to de-emphasize in some ways the power of attorneys and the power of the legal system. Because the real work in juvenile justice is in supporting young people and figuring out what's missing in their lives and how to fill those holes. And so, mentors, teachers, community service providers, folks in the mental health field, drug abuse counselors, gang intervention counselors, and really, very dramatically, the impact that employers can make in their willingness to give someone a chance despite having had contact with the juvenile criminal justice system. I think that ultimately, those arenas are potentially much more impactful than what lawyers or the legal system can necessarily do. And even just the willingness for the public to see these children as exactly that, to see their behaviors not as a sign that they are no longer children, but very much connected to of the essence and the particular vulnerabilities of children.
How much of your work is politically difficult? I mean, how much of this deals with selling issues either to the voters or to judges, or trying to convince someone that children should be treated as children and we should look at science to determine that?
So the legislative effort, Elizabeth Calvin gets so much credit for the work that she has done in legislative advocacy in the state of California. I mean, she has really been able to convince through the political process legislatures to really pass really very, very significant reforms. And so I think that, in the late 90s and the early 2000s, where it did not seem like a politically viable issue, it finally seems like that it is something that real reform can happen through the political process.
Well, that's pretty exciting for people to hear that something does happen through the legislative process. I know a lot of us feel that that's not always the case. What percentage of the people, I just want to go back into the system for a second. What percentage of the people that you see in the juvenile justice system currently end up showing up again in the adult criminal system?
It is a very, very, I mean, I don't have for you the statewide number. I would say that from our own representation, the numbers are really pretty grim. And I think that at the end of the day, the fact that we have really used the criminal justice system as a system of first resort, we've kind of cannibalized the community-based infrastructure that at the end of the day is really going to make a difference in terms of recidivism. And so, again, I would emphasize the role of civic society, the role of education, that, the criminal justice system in of itself is not going to solve these problems.
I think that's such an important message for our listeners to hear, that it sounds like we should be thinking about marrying the criminal justice system and particularly the juvenile justice system a lot more with our education system. And I wonder how it would change what you end up seeing maybe 16 years later if there was increased funding or increased interest in, let's say, preschool, kindergarten, elementary school? Is it true that a disproportionate number of the people that you end up dealing with in the juvenile justice clinic have faced problems from an early age on that maybe could have been alleviated had there been more support and infrastructure in place earlier?
I think so. I mean, our clients almost always have suffered multiple traumas, and that comes from insufficiencies in the education system, in family systems, in their neighborhoods. And I really think that your point about school is so important, because I think a lot of your listeners are probably familiar with this idea of the school-to-prison pipeline. You know, there's going to be a direct correlation with weaknesses in the education system and a growth in the juvenile justice and the criminal justice system. And that is because if schools are not adequately resourced to do the work that only they can really do, which is intervene in problematic behaviors where they occur, then there's always going to be an incentive to refer those behaviors to the criminal justice system because they don't know how to deal with it. And unless we give them the tools and the resources to do that work, then we're going to see a proportionate rise in activity in the juvenile justice system.
Well, this has been really educational for me, and I know for our listeners as well. I really appreciate you having a kind of free-flowing discussion about the juvenile justice system. It's really rare to be able to talk to an expert at this length and hear about all of your experiences, and it's been really helpful. And I want to thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Great. Again, I've been speaking with JoJo Liu. She is a clinical professor at Loyola Law School and the co-director of Loyola's Juvenile Justice Clinic. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Jessica Levinson, and I've been sitting in for Ian Masters. You can sign up for podcasts at ianmasters.com and stay up to date with my writing and tweets by following me at Levinson Jessica. Thanks to amazing producer Grant Fitzgibbon. And look forward to tomorrow when Amy Willents will be hosting. Bye. One more life.